This is Read On Air.
As anyone who knows me can tell you, I'm a great fan of detective stories. So when I heard that Kate Summerscale had set out to reinvestigate the Country House murder mystery that inspired the genre, 1860s Murder at Road Hill House, I didn't wait for it to come to the RNIB library. I went straight out and bought the CD box set. And The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher was even better than I'd hoped. Not only did it reveal facts about the case that I'd never known, but it read like a novel, a really good novel. No wonder it became a bestseller and was adapted for TV. Since then, Kate has brought her investigative rigour and her literary flair to another two cases. Mrs. Robinson's Disgrace, which was another bestseller, and last year, The Wicked Boy, The Mystery of a Victorian Child Murderer, which re-examines the case of a 13-year-old boy who murdered his mother, then took his younger brother to watch W.G. Grace open the batting at Lord's. Kate, thank you for joining us and welcome to Read On Air. A couple of years ago, you said something that I think sums up your writing. I'm a journalist, playing historian, and then I try and convert what I've found into something like a novel. And I believe that you were working as a journalist when you came across the material for your first book, The Queen of Whale Key.
Yes, that's right. I was writer and editor on the obituaries desk of the Daily Telegraph. This wild story about a female motorboat racer from the 1920s who dressed as a man, who was obsessed with a small leather doll, and who bought an island in the Bahamas and ruled it like a despot, came my way. And I embarked on trying to find out more, and it became my first book.
What makes your work so powerful is that it's character-driven. Mr. Witcher is quite a character. Was it he who attracted you to the story of the Road Hill House murder in the first place?
It was the case itself and the strangeness and horror of it that compelled me.
Mr. and Mrs. Kent were scouring the house for their son. "I was here, there and everywhere," said Mrs. Kent, "looking for him. We were all in a state of bewilderment, going backwards and forwards from room to room." Samuel extended the search to the grounds. "At about 7:30, said Holcomb, "he told the gardeners that young Master Saville was lost, stolen and carried away. That was all he said, and he ran round the garden. We went out directly in search of the child."
"I desired the gardeners to search the premises to see if they could find any trace of the child," explained Samuel. "I mean to say, traces of the child or anyone having left the premises."
Gough helped search the gardens and the shrubbery. Samuel asked the gardeners if there were any policemen nearby.
It was a 3-year-old boy in a middle-class family, prosperous family in the countryside, who was taken from his bed and murdered, his throat cut.
Foley watched over Saville's corpse again the next day. All the Mrs. Kent came to kiss the boy's body, as did Elizabeth Gough. Afterwards, the nursemaid told Mrs. Kent that she had kissed the poor little child.
And it was clear that the culprit was somebody in his house, one of the servants or a member of his family.
"A crime has just been committed, which for mystery, complication of probabilities and hideous wickedness is without parallel in our criminal records. The security of families and the sacredness of English households demand that this matter should never be allowed to rest till the last shadow in its dark mystery shall have been chased away by the light of unquestionable truth. The horror of this case was that the corruption lay inside the domestic sanctum, that the bolts, locks and fastenings of the house were hopelessly redundant. The secret lies with someone who was within. The household collectively must be responsible for this mysterious and dreadful event. Not one of them ought to be at large till the whole mystery is cleared up. One or more of the family is guilty." The Morning Post article was reprinted in the Times the next day and in newspapers throughout the country over the rest of the week. "Let the best detective talent in the country be engaged," demanded the Somerset and Wilts Journal. On Thursday, a Wiltshire magistrate renewed his plea to the Home Secretary to send a detective to Road, and this time the request was granted. On Saturday, the 14th of July,
Sir George Cornwall Lewis, Lord Palmerston's Home Secretary, instructed Sir Richard Mayne, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, to dispatch an intelligent officer to Wiltshire as soon as possible. Inspector Witcher to go, Mayne scribbled on the back of the Home Office directive. The same day, Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher received his orders to head for Road.
It was the figure of Jack Witcher, the detective, who gave me my in and gave me a way of approaching the case that made it fresh. And also, I realised, showed me that this case had been a kind of template for detective fiction, and Witcher himself a figure for the detective hero that we still watch on television dramas today and read about in books.
None of the accounts that I'd read before actually really focused on Mr. Witcher as a human being. He was a policeman who barged his way into this rather standard Victorian family.
Partly this is a story about class, because the police, including the detectives, of which he was one of the first, were working class men. He was taking the roof off the apparently respectable, prosperous and educated family and finding all kinds of dark secrets, jealousies, betrayals going on within. And so part of the great attraction and disgust that the case aroused at the time and still is to do with the fact that he was exposing something really taboo in order to investigate the case. And he went in and fearlessly made his investigations and then made his accusation. And this was the really compelling thing about his story, was he went to the Road Hill House murder case in 1860 with a reputation as the Prince of Detectives. And he did a brilliantly astute job solving the murder, but he wasn't able to find the evidence to prove his case, and so it ruined him. Very soon afterwards, the person he had accused confessed, so he was vindicated. And I was very happy to discover that he went on to have a marvellous second career as a private investigator.
And I know that some of the listeners will know Mr. Witcher from the ITV series. How did you feel about the adaptation of your book?
I thought it was very good. I had recently finished the book and I felt, well, I've told the story my way. I have no expertise in television. So I was happy for someone who did know what they were doing in that field to tell the story their way. And I was very curious as to what would happen. And of course, it was very different from the book, because you have to do things differently for drama. It focused very much on two characters, and it was a kind of, you know, psychological drama between them without all the sort of digression and context that I enjoyed being able to put into the book. But I thought it was very good, and it was great fun when they then started inventing fictional stories for Witcher to investigate. My project, which was to sort of trace back from the fictional detectives of now to their origin, in fact, in Jack Witcher's life and work. And now here he was inspiring a fictional drama series on television very directly and under his own name, as it were. It was very interesting for me in that way as well.
That's wonderful. You've brought him back to life twice.
I've never written about anyone who is famous or well-known already. I'm much more sort of animated by people who have fallen through the cracks. I suppose they can feel a little bit more like my own creations. I feel a greater intimacy with them. To find people who no one's heard of and to have the challenge and adventure, almost like a detective's research in itself, of trying to find enough to make them vivid. It's not just about finding facts, it's about finding often dramatic things. I tend to choose rather lurid, sensational stories. And so it's a form of sort of escapism into another life. And the more obscure the life, the more exciting the task of reconstruction is.
Which I think brings us rather neatly on to Mrs. Robinson's disgrace, who, despite the fact that she was on trial, actually I ended up feeling that it was the Victorian establishment that you put on trial. whilst writing about her?
Yeah, she was a well-to-do Victorian married woman who was extremely unhappily married and whose husband read her diary and discovered, apparently, that she'd had an affair with a family friend. And he went crazy and he sued for divorce in one of the first cases after the passing of the Divorce Act. And she resisted the divorce and thus protected the family friend by claiming that she was an erotomaniac and that the diary was not fact but fiction, and that it had been a record of her fantasies and delusions. She was damning herself as a liar in order to protect the family of the man who she had had an affair with. And the husband was, of course, absolutely furious at this ruse. So it's a very sort of morally sort of intricate story about, you know, the rights and wrongs and the way in which the court handled and decided upon how to measure something so sort of unknowable as whether a woman's private writings should be given the weight of evidence in court or should be accepted as the ravings of a maniac.
Well, it's a wonderful read. The fantastic fact that Dickens turns up in the book and various other literary figures are actually passing through history as we are reading about the case.
There is a kind of a tangle, a confusion of fact and fiction. In the Mrs. Robinson's disgrace, most sort of crucially, is the diary fact or fiction? How can we tell? How does it matter? And the shapes in which I choose to tell the stories are very much derived from fiction. It's novels that influence me more than anything, and the stories I choose have a novelistic feel to them. But I have set myself the task of using only facts in the course of telling the story. So I think that the things that I'm interested in writing very much draw on both a history and a literary disciplines. And trying to tie the two together and seeing how they work upon each other is what really interests me.
And how did you come across The Wicked Boy?
I was browsing newspapers from the 1890s. I fancied it was a decade that I would like to write about. And I came across this story about the two boys, aged 12 and 13, who'd been found in a house in East London. And the neighbours had forced their way in because of the smell coming from the house in the summer of 1895 and had discovered the boy's mother's body lying in a room upstairs. And the older boy, the 13-year-old, immediately confessed and said that he'd murdered her, he'd done it with a knife, and that they had been in the house with her corpse for the previous 10 days, and they had been to Lord's to watch the cricket, they'd been fishing in Southend, they'd been to the theatre, basically living it up. Of course, the press, the Victorian press, have reacted with absolute sort of horror to this very callous and very sort of intimate crime. The boys were tried. They were charged with murder. And I was just absolutely fascinated by why. The older boy did it, but the two boys plotted their mother's murder together. And somehow the questions that were asked in the court and by the police were similar to, but not exactly the same as the questions that I wanted answered. And so I wanted to gather everything I could and sort of try to read between the lines and try to work out what had really happened here and what became of them. If we look at really terrible juvenile crimes now, of necessity, the perpetrators kind of vanish eventually. They're given new identities or remain incarcerated or whatever. But this is long enough ago, I thought there might be a chance that I would find out what happened to these two boys. I really wanted to sort of solve that mystery, and I hoped that that would help me solve the mystery of why they'd killed their mother.
The Victorians wanted to find out too what made a murderer and believed that the shape of the head could influence whether a man was going to be a murderer or not.
There was there were some sort of theories that were circulating in the popular press from continental Europe about the way a man's ears or a woman's ears stuck out or their eyes bulged or their chin receded were clues to the fact that they would be either lunatic or criminal. And so when these boys, Robert and Natty Coombs, appeared in court, there was a quality to the reporters writing about them, which was they were sort of being tested, their features were being sort of tested against these templates of criminal and lunatic physiognomy. There were pictures drawn of them, sometimes reflecting those theories. Of course, the place those theories take you, as some of the commentators in the press observed, was that if you were born with these terrible sort of degenerate flaws which would lead you to criminality or lunacy, it might be best that you be aborted at birth, as they put it. So there was a great outcry among some of the press to have both Natty and Robert hanged, whatever the cause of their crime, because it was better that they didn't breed and that they didn't exist.
Gosh, and the lurid fascination in the details, the minutiae, shows that, well, maybe things just haven't changed.
So in some ways, the coverage is quite shocking for its explicitness. The detail that's given about the decomposition of a corpse, about wounds and injuries, is to modern sensibilities quite shocking. The fascination, the sort of prurient desire to really know as much as you can, to almost get inside the house and see what happened, is very, very present in the press. And I'm aware it's also part of my project. You know, when I write these books, I'm aware that these impulses are quite complicated, and some of it is a kind of prurient curiosity, as well as an urge to understand. And to sort of unravel the reasons for sort of abnormal psychology and tragic events and so on.
Do you put a brake on yourself? Because you never sensationalise.
I think I tend to choose stories that are already so over-dramatised in their nature. They're so melodramatic and vivid and intense that it is necessary to write with some restraint, and it is unnecessary to add anything to it. In fact, it does the material a disservice to try to hype it up. Although the way in which I organise the material is a kind of interpretation and a comment. So in no way would I say that my views are not present. They are. But they're not present really in sort of adjectives and, you know, and overt interpretation. It's just sort of kind of how you do it. When I get very interested in the psychology and the fate of the boys, the murderers, the murderer and his brother, his accomplice, to forget about the victim, that's a way in which I have to correct myself and think again, you know, to make sure that in the interests of telling, that I don't get so caught up in trying to make some of the characters emotionally sympathetic that you sort of demonise other characters. So there are lots of sort of moral decisions of that kind to be taken along the way.
Well, Kate Summerscale, thank you very much for giving up so much of your time to speak to us on Read On Air.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
This is Read On Air.